This is Grow in Grace, a daily teaching ministry of Palmetto Baptist Church in Greenville, South Carolina. Why did James write a letter to the early church? He didn't want them to follow a vain, empty religion. Instead, he wanted them to establish a living faith that was perfectly complete. Today, Pastor Sam Horn will continue a sermon from James chapter 1, titled Tried and True. Let's listen together so we can grow in grace.
There's something that James is going after, and this is what he says. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know, there's something that you are aware of, there's something that you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be what? Perfect. That you may be complete, lacking in nothing. So James says, here's my objective. My objective is that your faith would be perfect. And the idea there is not sinlessness. James is actually going to tell you what he means by perfect. He's going to say, I want your faith to be complete. I want it to not be missing anything. In other words, I want you to have a powerful, living, dynamic faith as opposed to the empty religion that he describes in verse 26. He says, if anyone thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue, he deceives his heart. This person's religion is what? It's worthless. It's just vain. It's weightless. It has no power to it. And James says there is something that will damage the credibility of your faith. There is something that will damage the vitality of your faith, and it is when your faith becomes weightless, when it has no life, when it has no strength, when it is lacking something. And the heart of all of that for James is going to be this idea of double-mindedness. When you have a divided heart, when you have a double-mindedness in your soul, it damages the vitality and it destroys the credibility of your faith. And James says, now I know that's shocking to you. I'm going to say something even more shocking when we get to chapter 4, but I know it's shocking to you. But let me tell you how I know that this is going on in your life. Let me tell you how I know that some of you really are double-minded. Let me tell you how I know that some of you really do have a faith that is deficient. Some of you are self-deceived about sin and temptation. That's what he's going to say to them in verse 16. This is how I know that this is going on in your midst. Some of you are deceiving yourselves about temptation. Some of you are hearing the word and you celebrate it and then you walk out and you don't do it. You are hearers but not doers. Some of you are exhibiting ungodly partiality toward others in chapter 2, verses 1 through 13. For some of you, you have a really good confession, but your life does not display the works of faith. And that's in chapter 2, verses 14 through 16. James says, let me just talk to you straight about what comes out of your mouth, how you use your tongue. You know how I know you have a divided heart? Because you have a double tongue. You have a double-minded heart. Because you have and the reason I know that is because what's coming out of your mouth. One time we meet you and there are these wonderful blessings that are coming out of your mouth. And the next time we run into you, your mouth is saying things that are horrifically offensive. And this is because you have a damaged faith. You have embraced and are displaying wisdom from below instead of wisdom from above in chapter 3, verses 13 through 18. You presume on God. You think you can go do whatever you want with your life. You can go to this city. You can go to that city. There is no thought for the will of God in your daily life. That's in chapter 5, verses verses 13 through 17. And some of you are even living in ways that are taking advantage of one another. And that's in chapter 5, verses 1 through 6. That's why James says, I know exactly that we have a problem, because all of these symptoms are in your life and they are pointing back to something that is going wrong with your faith. And James says, my objective is to bring you to a place where you are restored to a living, dynamic faith that can make a difference in a dying world. My objective is that your faith would not be lacking, that it would be complete, that it would be strong and vital, that it would be wholehearted, that it would be single-focused, that it would be fully trusting. Now, that brings us to the second thing that James is going to point out, and that is this. How does God accomplish this? And God accomplishes this through a very surprising means. He uses trials of various kinds. When you are a believer living in a pagan context under pressure, God is going to use that pressure to reveal things about you and about your faith. When James is talking about faith, by the way, let's make sure we understand what he means. He's not just talking about the content of what they believed. In fact, I don't think James is worried that there's some doctrine that they fail to believe or some doctrine that they have believed wrongly. I don't think that James is particularly worried about the content of their belief. What they have professed about Jesus, what they have professed about his work, his atoning work, what they have professed about the resurrection. I don't think James is worried about the content of their faith. I think James is worried about whether or not they really believe what they say they believe, and whether or not those beliefs are actually what they're trusting. Because whatever you're trusting is what you're going to use to build your life. If you really believe that Jesus Christ is coming again and has promised you a kingdom, if you really believe that, then that's what you're going to live for in this world. Correct? And that's where James is headed with all of this. And so he says that God is going to use trials in our life. He talks about the reality of trials. You are going to encounter them. And he talks about the multiplicity of them. There are going to be many of them, and they're not all going to look the same in your life. They're not going to come at the same time, and they're not going to be in the same arena, but trials are going to be the repeated way in which God cultivates in you a faith that is wholehearted, single focused, and fully trusting. That's how God is going to do it. And trials have a particular reason. When we talk about a trial, we're talking about a test. We're talking about taking something and testing it. And the point of the test is to see whether it's genuine and to see whether it's sound and to see whether it works. If you take a brand new ocean liner that is fresh off the dock, before you put 3,000 or 4,000 human lives on that ship and take them out on the ocean, you want to know that that ship is sound. And so before you ever put passenger one on that ship, there is a crew that takes that ship out for sea tests or sea trials. And they take that ship out and they put it through all of its routines. They expose it to everything they can imagine that it will be exposed to when it's actually on a journey. And they are wanting to know that that ship isn't going to cave in under pressure, that that ship is actually going to sail and to be safe, and that it can actually endure whatever the sea or the ocean throws at it. And that's the point of a test that God introduces into your life. He is going to expose things about your faith. He is going to confirm things about your faith, and he is going to build things into your faith. How does God develop in us wholeheartedness? How does God develop in us single-mindedness, single-focused? How does God develop in us a faith that fully trusts in him? And the answer is, he has to put us in a place where we have nothing else to do if we're going to be loyal to God but to trust what he said in his word. He's going to have to put us out in the ocean, and he's going to have to send a storm our way, and we're going to have to decide, are we going to trust the wisdom that came down from above that's contained in the law of the Lord, or are we going to go looking for other wisdoms because we're afraid that wisdom isn't enough? And that's James, that's where he's headed with his readers, and that's really where he's headed with us. And he points something out, that a test, when we go through the pressure that God introduces into our life, there is an intended result, and the intended result is perseverance, steadfastness. You can see that, can't you? For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness have its full effect. And so James says, listen, God is going to do something unusual in order to reveal things about your faith, in order to confirm to others that your faith really is true, it's genuine, and to build things into your faith so that at the end of the day, as you live all around the world under this persecution that is driving you down, you will remain loyal as a friend of God, and you will manifest a wholehearted, single-focused, fully trusting faith. The kind of faith that drew me to Christ, the kind of faith that drew you to Christ. And James says there's a response to all of this. You need to evaluate trials properly. You need to think about trials in the right way. He said, consider. That's a word that means to evaluate. That's what you do when you take stock. That's what you do when you sit down and you want to count up and you want to know exactly what's going on and you want to know exactly where you are. I mean, sometimes we have those conversations as a couple, right? We sometimes just need to sit down at the table and we need to just clear the decks and we need to get whatever beverage, whether it's coffee or tea or whatever, and we just need to say, look, we need to take stock of where we are. We need to count up what is going on. We need to get a really clear picture so that we can evaluate properly. And James says, you need to take stock of the trial and you need to evaluate what it's really doing. And when you understand what a trial is really doing, instead of being something that you dread and you just endure, it becomes something that you consider as an occasion of joy. What is going to come out of this is going to be good. And then James says, you don't just need to evaluate it, you need to embrace it. He says, let steadfastness have its full effect. Don't try to run out from under the pressure before steadfastness has done its full work. Don't cut the trial short because you want to relieve the pressure. If you understand what this trial is doing, it is confirming things about your faith. It is revealing things about your faith. And it is building things into your faith. Don't cut the trial short. Let steadfastness have its full effect. And that brings us to the third thing. Do we have in Scripture examples of people who let steadfastness have its full effect? And the answer is yes. Let me give you three. In Hebrews 11:6, it says, without faith, it is impossible to do what? To please God. All right, so if you want to please God, that's really, you know, if you have a wholehearted, single-focused, fully trusting faith, the end of that faith is a life that pleases God. So if you want to please God, you have to have this kind of faith. Can we see examples of this in the Scripture? And let me just give you three. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 7, we read this. By faith, Noah, being warned by God concerning events as yet unseen, in reverent fear, constructed an ark for the saving of his household. By this he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. You know what's interesting? In Genesis chapter 6, verse 9, Noah is described this way. Noah was a righteous man, perfect in his generations. And it's the same idea that James is talking about when he says, let steadfastness have its perfecting work so that you may be perfect, complete. Here's an example in the Old Testament of somebody who was that. He was perfect. He was complete. His faith lacked nothing. And the evidence of all of that was the fact that for 120 years, he built a boat when there was no ocean to be seen. This was clearly not something that you were going to sail on in the river Tigris or the river Euphrates, much less the Jordan. I mean, this was a massive boat. And so all along, people are coming up to Noah and they want to know, what in the world are you doing? I mean, think about the immense amount of resources that Noah invested in building this boat. I'm sure that throughout Noah's life, that boat became known by many things. Maybe it was called Noah's Folly. I'm sure Noah and his family had to answer more than once, why in the world are you building that boat? It's clearly not a fishing boat. It's clearly too big for you guys to just be taking a little pleasure cruise up the Euphrates because you can't even get the boat there. This is the wrong place to build a boat. This is the wrong size of a boat to build. And I have no idea why in the world you're doing this. And all Noah could say is this: God said there's a flood coming, and God said to build this boat. And they're like, what's a flood? That's a word we're not familiar with. Well, flood is like lots of water that rises and comes like from the sky, and it comes up from the ground, and it's just gonna flood everything. And they're going, we've never seen a flood. This is crazy. And Noah said, I'm building this boat because I fear God, and he told me to build it. That's what it meant for 120 years. Let me give you another example. Abraham. In Hebrews 11, 17 through 19, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received promises was in the act of offering up his only son. In verse 19, he considered, there's our word that James is talking about. He considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead. I mean, here is Abraham who manifests unwavering belief and full-hearted trust in God's promise during an intense time that demanded everything from him. And if you want the final example, it's Jesus who manifests unwavering belief in God's character during a physically painful and emotionally devastating life-ending trial. James says, you want some models for what this looks like? It looks like Noah, who fully trusted God's words. It looks like Abraham, who fully trusted God's promise, and it looks like Jesus, who fully trusted God's plan. Let me ask you a question. Do you fully trust God's words? That's where James is going with this. Do you fully trust God's words? No matter how hard it gets, no matter how long the trial is, no matter how hard it crushes you down, do you trust God's words? Do you trust God's promises? And do you trust God's plan? There's a fourth thing that James talks about here in this text. He says, look, God is going to use trials to build into you, to reveal the condition of your faith. He's going to build resilience into your faith. He's going to craft resolute conviction into your faith about God's words and God's promises and God's plans for your life. And he's going to use trials to do that, but here's what you're going to need. If you're going to navigate the trial the way Noah did, or if you're going to navigate the trial the way that Abraham did, or if you're going to do what Jesus did when Peter describes him as keeping entrusting himself, continuing to trust him, entrust himself to the one who judges justly. If you're going to do that, you're going to need a wisdom. And that's the fourth thing that he talks about. He talks about a spiritual requirement, wisdom from above. And look at verse 5. If any of you lack wisdom, and then he immediately tells you where to go to get that wisdom. Because there were a ton of other wisdoms available. In every one of those cities, they could go to just about any temple. They could go to just about any school of thought. They could go to any philosopher in the city, and they could get wisdom that would give them answers about how to navigate all of this pressure. And James says, if you are going to navigate life under pressure in a way that develops in you a faith that is wholehearted, single-focused, and fully trusting, you're going to have to go to the right source for wisdom. And the wisdom you're looking for is not coming from beneath. It is coming from above. It is the wisdom that came down from God that the psalmist in Psalm 1 verse 2 described as the law of the Lord. And James is going to remind you that this wisdom is not innate in you. You were not born with this wisdom. It is a wisdom that has to be implanted in you. It has to be received by you. That's why in chapter 1, verse 21, he says, receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to deliver you. James says, if you want to navigate trial in such a way that it produces what God intends to produce about your faith, you're going to need a wisdom that comes from God that you receive when it's implanted in your heart. You're going to need that kind of wisdom. And it actually produces certain qualities. Wisdom isn't just intellectual. It's not primarily just the right information. Remember, we said that James is not worried that his people have believed the wrong things. He's worried about the condition of their belief. He's not worried so much about whether they have the Word of God and whether that information is available to them. It is. He's worried about what that information is producing in them and why it isn't producing the things it should. It should be producing, for example, purity and peaceableness and reasonableness and graciousness and gentleness and mercy and moral goodness and impartiality and sincerity, single-heartedness. That is the mark of wisdom from above that James is going to talk about in chapter 3, verses 17 through 18. But if you go back to what we just said earlier, none of those things were true in the lives of some of these people. And that's why James has said, you're going to have to come to the right place for the right wisdom to navigate your life. And you say, well, that's easy. I'll just come to the scriptures. And James says, no, there is a condition. There is a condition that God has placed on that wisdom working in your life. And that condition is this: you have to come without doubt. You have to come without doubt. And he's going to connect doubt to another idea. He's going to connect doubt to double-mindedness. He says the person who doubts is double-minded. So when we think about the idea of doubt, here's what James wants you to catch. He is thinking about a person who has a divided heart. The word doubt has the idea of a person trying to discern, trying to decide. I'm trying to decide something. I'm struggling with a decision. I'm divided in what I am thinking. That's a doubter. So are you doubting? The idea is, are you struggling to be in or out? This is the idea. James has said, when you come to God as a believer, wanting to have wholehearted, single-focused, fully trusting faith, you cannot come as a doubter. You cannot come as someone whose heart has not fully been set to God. You have to come like Deuteronomy chapter 6 talks about, and like Jesus said, you have to come with a heart that loves the Lord with all of its strength, with all of its might, and with all of its force.
Thank you, Pastor Sam. We'll continue this sermon next time on Grow in Grace. Today's speaker, Dr. Sam Horn, is the pastor for preaching and vision at Palmetto Baptist Church. PBC meets at 2730 Anderson Road, Greenville, South Carolina. Join us for Sunday morning worship at 9 a.m. or 10:45 a.m. You can find us online at pbcpowdersville.org. If you have any questions about PBC, please email radio@pbcpowdersville.org. Thanks for listening. Join us again next time so together we can grow in grace.